So what we have is a very, very complex network of cumulative effects of regulatory impacts that I would say is the major issue that our members are facing. And that's something that we're talking very regularly with the government about and looking at ways that we can alleviate some of those burdens.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 104, episode 104 of the Flux Capacitor. That's more than 100 conversations about the future of the business of electricity. I have chatted with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector, on coffee breaks, at industry conferences, on the margins of regulatory hearings, or over a drink following a parliamentary committee appearance. This episode of the pod is a policy conversation about hydropower in Canada. My guest on the podcast today is
Lorena Patterson, President and CEO of Water Power Canada.
Lorena joined the podcast for a conversation on the role and current state of water power in Canada. We talk about the complexity of the regulatory and project approval regimes and the role hydropower will continue to play in Canada's electricity future. She also shares perspectives as someone with experience in energy in a number of jurisdictions in North America. We close the conversation with her great recommendation for a book to add to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with Lorena Patterson, recorded on Zoom in mid-December 2024.
So for the listener, can you give us a bit of a background on Water Power Canada, where it came from, what it does, who it represents?
Water Power Canada came about because obviously when we're looking at Canada's electricity mix, we have a lot of different technologies. We use gas, we use, in, you know, some remote areas use diesel, we've got renewables. There are a lot of different technologies that we use across the grid. And the association was formed in order to represent the interests of companies that use hydropower. The reason for that was they wanted to have a space where they could just talk about issues that impact them. So, for example, the Fisheries Act is something that is really important for our members that impacts their ability to operate in many cases, as well as build new facilities. And those kinds of conversations are best carried out at a table that is of these companies that are impacted by that. Mm-hmm. So the intent for it was really just to be able to get into some of those really deep issues that only impact this segment of our national.
Gotcha, gotcha. So if you're looking at kind of the environment that we're operating in now, what are some of the big issues that your association and your members are facing? You know, are there some that kind of fall into the strategic category? Are there big operational issues? So what are the things that are occupying the membership today?
I would say both of those things. So Canada is a very responsible country. We have a lot of legislation to ensure that we are safeguarding the environment and that we're working hard to maintain our environment and our resources for generations to come. I think across the country, you'll find all companies pretty much are maintaining that interest in regardless of which field they're working in. Mm-hmm. And what we are facing, however, is perhaps an overabundance of caution in terms of regulatory restrictions on members, both from an operational perspective as well as for new builds. So, for example, there are many regulations that are similar but not the same between provinces and the federal government for projects that are subject to a federal review. And in some of those cases, those differences are reconcilable. The companies have to choose between either the provincial, following the provincial guidelines or the federal guidelines because they can't do both.
Right.
There are also instances where an eagerness to protect every single fish under the Fisheries Act impedes regular maintenance of and expansions of facilities that could contribute to Canada's clean growth, clean energy growth. And it's also using resources for monitoring fish, regardless of whether they're endangered or impacted in a large in a significant way. Those resources are being used for that purpose, as opposed to expanding our energy production so that we can fuel electric vehicles and other things that we're doing to further protect our environment. So what we have is a very, very complex network of cumulative effects of regulatory impacts that I would say is the major issue that our members are facing. And that's something that we're talking very regularly with the government about and looking at ways that we can alleviate some of those burdens.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the Fisheries Act as an example. I think we both appeared, I think, in the same week in front of the parliamentary committee that's reviewing that. As you noted, it now protects fish as opposed to protecting fisheries. What are the sorts of things that your members are looking for in terms of just take the Fisheries Act as an example? What do you think we need to do to make it workable?
Well, first and foremost, I think we have to apply a reasonable test to everything that we do. So we should be focused on maintaining healthy watersheds, healthy rivers, healthy lakes, making sure that the habitat is adequate for sustainable production of whatever fish or other aquatic life might be in that watershed for the future. Instead of focusing on individual fish that are occasionally impacted by these sorts of facilities. We are focusing very much on restricting facilities from doing what they need to do, as opposed to focusing on are we creating a healthy environment for these fish for the future. So I would say clarity is very important in terms of interpretation of the legislation, and that clarity must include a reasonableness test. It doesn't make sense to restrict a facility from impacting even one fish if you're giving out licenses or selling licenses for commercial fishing or for recreational fishing in the same watershed for numbers that could be significantly higher than those that are impacted by the facility in operation, or requiring extreme monitoring measures for firms that are already replacing any potential population that might be impacted by their facilities by creating environments elsewhere that increase the population of fish by 2 or 3 times. So I think overall, what we would look for in the Fisheries Act is something that is very clear that allows companies to do the operations and maintenance of the existing facilities, some of which have been around for 150 years. And allow for further growth with obviously adequate measures put into place to ensure the future sustainability of these fisheries, but focusing on the fisheries and the fish habitat as opposed to every individual fish.
Right. No, that's great. I think the message that a number of us were trying to bring forward to that parliamentary committee. Hopefully, we'll get some traction with it. But I liked how you put it a couple of minutes ago. You talked about, the complexity and the cumulative effects of these different regulatory instruments. One of the questions that was asked when I was in front of the parliamentary committee was, given the change in the overall and greater complexity of the regulatory environment within which we operate, how long would it take today if somebody wanted to embark upon trying to build, for example, a major hydro facility? I mean that I think that question kind of goes to the heart of the challenge of a more complex regulatory environment that within which the industry is operating. What would that look like today, given, the changes that we've seen to the Impact Assessment Act and the Fisheries Act and other instruments? Like, how complex would it be for somebody to I don't know, try and build a another, you know, another site C or you know, another major facility today to go through those hoops.
Well, and this is precisely the point because
Oh.
capital, as you know, is very flighty and can go anywhere. And investors typically like to get returns on their investments. And our crown corporations are struggling with this because it takes at least a decade to go through the regulatory process. And in all reality, that's on paper, it takes about 5 years. But if you're actually taking into account potential stoppages,
Yeah.
further monitoring requirements, and what have you, and consultation process, which can be very extensive, you're probably looking at a minimum of 10 years in order to get regulatory approval for some of these things. And that's not unusual in this industry. Site C, I think, was first proposed 34 years before construction began.
Right.
And that was prior to the current environmental environment that we have, or sorry, regulatory environment that we have. So we are struggling with how do we continue the growth of this great resource, which is dispatchable, clean, doesn't produce waste, doesn't impact the water. How do we continue to encourage the growth of this industry in an environment that makes it so difficult to bring new projects into operations? And is it reasonable for these projects to go through 10 years of regulatory reviews when other markets are doing similar reviews in less than half that time? Are we gaining what we hope to as a country by adding in these additional years and additional requirements for monitoring and for consultation that you don't have to go through in other markets? You know, I think as a country, we have to look at whether or not we're getting the return on our investment. And I would point out that this week, Alberta announced a massive investment in data centers that's going into the northern part of that province, which is actually where I'm from, coincidentally. And the reason it's going there is because they have a secure supply of energy for years through the natural gas that's available there, and they don't have to go through a federal process because it's all going to be managed provincially. So, you know, are all our provinces going to be able to take advantage of those sorts of opportunities? Given where we are with some of the regulatory requirements that we have. And those are very serious questions and they're difficult questions. It also goes to the affordability of our grid across the country. So there are a lot of things I think that we need to probably be discussing across the board and seeing how each component of the industry can be taking its advantages to the table and making things as affordable and as simple as possible for the Canadian consumer to use at the end of the day, because that's really where we want to go.
Right. So if we look at, you know, right now we've got commitments and aspirations that the government has made out to 2035 for you know, what they term as a net zero grid out to 2035. That's a decade away. So I mean, if it's that complex to build a hydro facility and it takes at least a decade. One would conclude that hydro may play an important and critical role in our 2050 targets, but it looks like if it takes 10 years to get something built, those additional projects that we hope to see coming online may not be on part of the calculus for 2035.
I would agree with that. I think, you know, in energy terms for large scale infrastructure projects, 2035 is tomorrow, and we haven't started yet. So it's going to be very difficult to meet that target. And again, we're working against ourselves because if the goal is to reach net zero and the goal is to bring more clean energy onto the grid, then some steps needed to come and be in place for us to enable that to happen. And unfortunately, they went the other direction and made it more difficult and harder. So it's kind of a catch-22 that where we are right now in terms of the regulatory requirements and the initiatives that the government wants to have in place in order to reach those goals. So ironically, what they're doing by making it so difficult for sectors like ours is encouraging growth of natural gas facilities, which can be put into place much sooner. Because the power requirements, I mean, one thing is net zero, but we also have growing power requirements for our grid. And eventually it gets to the point where you have no option except to look for the easiest path, and that might not be the cleanest path. And we could do both, but under the current environment, it would be very complex to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, one of the things that I ask everybody that comes onto the podcast is about their journey. I think the listeners are always interested in terms of what people's journey has been. And I make the joke when you were a kid on the playground, did you dream of one day running a National Association for Water Power in Canada?
No, I can definitely tell you I did not.
So what was your journey from the playground to this role?
Well, actually, it's been obviously very circuitous as everyone's is. But I started off, I would say, with a keen interest in international travel. I was a student when I was 17 in Brazil. I was there for a year.
Oh.
Learned Portuguese, and one of the things that I toured, because we did this big tour around the whole country, was Itaipu, which at the time was the largest water power facility that had ever been built. I remember it to this day. It was absolutely massive, and I had no idea that I would ever work in that industry. Had to have a lot explained to me at the time, but I still remember it very vividly. It was in a beautiful setting, very close to Iguazu Falls, which is an incredible incredible set of waterfalls in northern Argentina, southern Brazil. So highly recommended if anyone ever gets the opportunity to go there. But from there, I went back to Canada, to university. I studied Spanish, went to Spain as part of my studies. I studied international development, worked for the Alberta government for a little while, and then I went to Mexico to work with a consulting company. And ended up staying there a lot longer than I'd planned. I met my husband, and as these things go, came back in 2000 to Calgary, and then in 2001 went back down to Mexico. Actually, 2002, sorry, went back down to Mexico to be the first Alberta government representative at the embassy in Mexico City. And then from there, I worked with TC Energy for many years developing pipelines in Mexico. Came back to Canada in 2018, left TC in 21. And since then, I've done a few things. I worked with Natural Resources Canada for a little bit. And then I took a complete 180 degree turn and started working with the alcohol industry for a couple of years.
Oh.
And then I was hired by Water Power Canada to come into the position of president and CEO. So it's been a long journey. Lots of twists and turns, but always, I would say, very focused on the regulatory issues in particular. Mexico was developing its regulatory system when I was there. I worked closely with their national regulator on some of the natural gas regulations that they were bringing in as they were encouraging pipeline growth at the time, which was fascinating. There was a very strong admiration for Canada's regulatory environment back then. And we encouraged a really close relationship between the regulators at that time. So that was quite interesting. And then the regulatory environment for alcohol is also insane. It's I always thought it was yet energy was unique, and I'm sorry to say it's not. There are a lot of restrictions there, and the added complexity of having to deal with multiple monopolies for that actually make a lot more off of your product than the producers do. So yeah, so that's a whole other story. But that's kind of my route. Very happy to be back in Canada. I'm very disappointed in some of the tariff conversations that have been going on recently. I supported Mexico actually during the last renegotiation of the NAFTA agreement. I was at the time the president of the Natural Gas Association for Mexico, so I was at the table with on the Mexican side. We were discussing an energy chapter actually that was quite fulsome and quite complex, but encouraged a lot more integration between the three countries, and we were very excited about it. And it was pulled at the last minute when there was a change in government from Mexico, and obviously things have changed significantly since then. But I am watching the current discussion very closely, and obviously don't support the thought of having increased tariffs across our three countries. I think we have a lot more to gain by being integrated than we do by being separated. And particularly on the energy side, there's a lot of infrastructure that we already share, and we could be doing a lot more to help build up the resiliency of our grids. So I'm hoping to see that trend perhaps shift.
Yeah, well, I share the sentiment, absolutely, and and I've been spending a little more time in Washington, and we'll be back again next week to continue to look at where we can either gain greater insights or see if there's opportunities for us to find partners in this space. Because yeah, I mean, to your point, electricity trade has never had any kind of a tariff ever. In the more than 100 years that we've been trading it back and forth across the border, and our colleagues in the auto manufacturing sector do talk about things that cross back and forth across the border. But yeah, with respect to electricity, the flows both ways, and the complexity and the ability to continue to reliably operate these regional grids is something that we need to be keeping our eye on for sure.
It does, and I think it would be terrible if it were the unintended consequence of a negotiating technique to try and pressure Canada or Mexico on this, because energy and electricity is fundamental to life, particularly in northern climates. And it doesn't make any sense to punish people who have no choice but to purchase it. And you can't really choose where you purchase it from, typically. It's you and the consumer has no idea what's behind the fence. So, does it make sense just to randomly increase prices by that much for them in the coldest months of the year? Yeah, not from my perspective. I think generally you want to safeguard consumers from those sorts of peaks in pricing and try and keep energy costs as low as possible, because that's how you encourage growth of anything, whether it's housing or industry development. The lower cost your energy input, the more attractive you are as a market. So it just seems self-defeating to even be discussing tariffs on energy and electrons. But here we are. So, I'm hoping that cooler heads will prevail, and that people with influence in the United States will be encouraging their legislators not to go there. We are speaking closely as well with our American counterparts, trying to discourage this direction. So hopefully we'll be successful in those efforts. But yeah, we are very concerned.
All right, let's get back to some of our domestic questions. As we look to the future, there are predictions that electricity demand out to 2050 is gonna double or triple depending upon where you are in the country. Water power right now, well, Canada is 84% non-emitting in terms of our electricity today. The bulk of that is from water power. What about 60% of our generation today is from water power. What is that going to look like when we project out to that system that's going to be significantly bigger than it is today? Will hydro continue to be the backbone of the system, and will it continue to be how we bring other renewables on and provide the stability to the grid? Is it going to continue to grow? So
We
what is it?
believe so. We
Yeah.
believe so. Yes, we absolutely believe so. There is still some room for some large projects, given the if some modifications to the regulatory environment. Yes, absolutely, we could see more large hydro. There you'll see a lot of expansions and refurbishments and mini hydro developments as well. There are lots of opportunities for those. We believe that we will continue to be the background, the logical backbone for renewables, because we are dispatchable. We provide that stability to the grid that you need for those times when conditions aren't favorable for production of solar or wind. We absolutely want to be part of that growth and intend to be part of that growth. It will depend, obviously, to some degree, on the region of the country that we're in terms of how much potential there is, because we are dependent on the resources that are there. But we do believe that we will continue to be a significant part of Canada's energy production, and we are the reason why our grid is as clean as it is.
So if the planets align, if we manage to sort out some of the regulatory challenges and eliminate some of those cumulative effects, if we're able to grow our hydro sector to you know to the to the degree it would naturally grow as things expand. How big will potentially that the hydro sector be when you project out into the future? Is you know what's
Well,
the
I think we can certainly get close to doubling what we
right.
currently have for production.
Right.
Yeah, if Canada's grid triples, I expect our proportion will go down, as a percentage of the overall grid, as it does typically when you have a larger grid. Less of it is it would be composed of hydro, but certainly we can, I think, probably maintain a similar proportion if we're looking at doubling. Canada and the United States have a similar production of megawatts in hydropower, but we're only 6% of the American grid.
Right.
So it's all to somewhat degree it's to somewhat to some degree it's all dependent on the growth of the population as well, and the other sections of the grid that will be built out over that time.
And so, yeah, from what you said a couple of minutes ago, that growth is going to come from a couple of different aspects, refurbishments, small hydro, and some potentially some large plants as well. I
Yes.
guess depending upon what the opportunities are in each of the regions.
Exactly. And one of the things as well, and that I think we should also keep in mind is not just those big macro goals, but also the smaller impacts that the mini hydro can have on remote communities, for example. One of our members put a mini hydro facility into a remote community that had been depending on diesel production for decades. And as you know, it's noisy, it's dirty, it's expensive. It's a bit of a constant threat because if the generator goes down, you have to fix it. It's the middle of January, it's unpleasant. They put in this mini hydro facility there, and they were able to shut those diesel turbines down. And obviously, there are benefits in terms of the operating costs, but also the silence. They talk about the silence in the community that was returned to them as a side benefit of having this different technology brought into the community. So those sorts of things, I think you'll see more of. It's a technology that lives very well alongside a community, and doesn't create the same sorts of concerns that some other things might. So I think we'll see that as well.
Okay. So if I could summarize, it sounds as though financing and sort of capital isn't the problem. It sounds like technology isn't the problem. It sounds like what we need to do is to figure out how to get through these effects of the complex regulatory environments within which we operate and sort those to the ground. Would that be a fair summary?
Well, I would say to some degree there is a problem with financing because as we've made the regulatory environment more complex, and we've transferred a lot of the risk onto the developers and the contractors that have to put the projects into service, build and put them in service, we are seeing a less enthusiastic financial stakeholder perspective on some of these large projects. So it is I think it's incumbent on the government to figure out how they can achieve whatever their objectives are in terms of regulatory oversight without impacting these projects to some as they're currently seeing. So in cases where you have large crown corporations, it's less of an issue, but ultimately, those additional risks that come into play from having extra years of oversight or extra rounds of consultations or more complex agreements, those costs will be passed on to the ratepayer regardless. So there is a financial component to this as well.
And then the one other topic that I wanted to touch on, and we haven't had an opportunity to jump on it yet, is indigenous participation in projects as we move forward, and potentially the role that participation in these projects can play in what's been termed as reconciliation. I would imagine for your members, this is a very much a front and center conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fundamentally important. Water is the most important resource to Indigenous communities, regardless of where they are. And in every country, it's their primary concern, and they have a very significant relationship with the watersheds wherever they are. We are very concerned with making sure that we are engaging meaningfully with these communities, that we're bringing them on board. You'll see, I think, a lot more equity arrangements with these communities as projects are fully developed and built. And it works out very well for both sides when an agreement can be made, because the concerns of those communities are brought into the project. Their concerns are incorporated into the environmental assessment process, and their sacred plants are safeguarded, and their concerns are looked after. So it's a very beneficial relationship on both sides, and I would say it's one of the most fundamental developments that we see as an industry in Canada in particular. I'm actually quite proud of the advances that Canada's made in this regard, because after living in Mexico for so long and seeing some of those indigenous communities in Mexico that don't have those considerations, I'm very thankful that we actually have a framework to do this here. It's much, much, it's something that actually I think we should be proud of. We have a long way to go still, but we've made a lot of progress.
Yeah, and that's you went exactly where I was hoping we'd go because of the time that you spent in other countries, in Mexico in particular. You've got a different different perspective, and you've seen it from a couple of different in a couple of different jurisdictions. So yeah, I was interested to kind of get a sense of how you would rate how we approach this as compared to what you've seen elsewhere, particularly with the significant amount of time you spent in Mexico.
Yeah, I think we get a lot of things right in Canada, and we often don't give ourselves enough credit for what we do get right.
Wow.
And I think sometimes we overshoot our objectives, because in many cases in the recent legislation that's come in, we were already doing a lot of the things that have now been prescribed in the legislation. And I don't think there was adequate consideration given to the fact that companies actually are quite responsible here. And I can speak to that with some authority, having seen things that I saw in Mexico. So, and they are trying there as well, but when you have limited resources, it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to get to these places. And Canada has so many resources. We are so blessed here. I think sometimes we forget about that as well. Over 2% of Mexico's population still has no access to power. And that's about 2.5 million people. When you look in absolute numbers, that's an incredible number of people that don't have power. So what they do is they go out and they find wood to burn, and they don't have power in their homes. So the children, if they go to school, they can't do their homework at night. They have to do it during the days of day, or the hours of daylight. And often they don't go to school because they have to go and gather wood, because that's a pretty primary requirement for life. So to the degree that we can overcome those sorts of things and make sure that everybody has access to energy, and if I'm looking at the North American context, there's a lot that can still be done in as a trilateral relationship to encourage that sort of growth, to ensure that those remote communities and those people that don't have access to energy of any sort can have it. And then we can grow as a region. That's still a vision that I believe in, regardless of where we are right now geopolitically. The fact is, we have so many resources in Canada, but we don't have enough people. Mexico has an excess of people, and they've got a lot of resources as well. They're not a resource poor area. They've got a lot of resources. They need perhaps some more, I think a different political direction than they're having right now. But they have more to provide us than they do if we shut them off. And we recently, the Premier of Ontario and the Premier of Alberta have made comments about kicking them out of NAFTA. And that might be an attractive sound bite, but there are people behind all of this, and that's a a significant concern, or should be a significant concern, because if you ignore the impact that this will have on people, you're encouraging, generally a negative outcome, I think, because that's when you get unrest. That's when you it's easier for drug traffickers to influence those remote communities.
Right.
The only way to really bring them into our fold is through development. I'm hoping that cooler heads will prevail, and eventually we will get there. And energy and electricity is such a fundamental part of that.
Yeah.
They do have a lot of hydro in Mexico as well, and they use it to maintain. They're much closer to the razor edge than we are, shall we say. So they do have occasional blackouts and things that they're dealing with right now, and they use those hydro resources really much more intensely than we do, to try and maintain the balance on their system. And I could see more hydro development there happening as well.
Right.
So anyway, long-winded answer, but I do think we need to always maintain in our minds that we are actually performing a very basic service for everyone. This isn't just about the facilities that are on the rivers. This is about the electrons that flow into everyone's homes and businesses and keep us going and keep us warm in the winter. And I think those of us that are in the industry should be very proud of that.
Lorena, at this point in the podcast, this is where I always ask people to come on the podcast for a book recommendation. We add it to our Flux Capacitor Book Club list. So today, what book would you add to our reading list?
One of the books that I'm reading right now is Indian in the Cabinet by Jodi Wilson-Raybould. I find her insights to be enlightening, both from a female perspective, because we've seen a lot of things in the past few years. I think that we've wondered about her insights are very helpful in understanding some of that political question and that some of the things that women face in politics. And obviously, her background as coming from a First Nation as well is extremely interesting and helpful, and I think educational. So I would highly recommend that one.
All right, so we are most definitely adding to our list a great recommendation. It's Indian in the Cabinet, Speaking Truth to Power by Jodi Wilson-Raybould. Terrific.
That's right.
Great addition. Thanks. Thank you very much, Lorena. Really appreciate you taking the time to join the podcast and sh sharing some interesting perspectives because of some of the different roles that you've had in the past. But I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Francis. And I really want to also mention how much we look forward to working with you and your team on the broader energy question in general, electricity question across Canada. I know you and your members are doing great work, and you're also similarly aligned in terms of the regulatory environment in particular that we're contending with right now. And I thank you very much for all your support.
Oh, and right back at you. I think it's helpful when in the same week, you and I are appearing from in front of parliamentary committees, perhaps on different days, but with very similar messages, with the same concerns, and with the same fundamental concern at the bottom of it about affordability and reliability for customers in the end. But yeah, listen, we'll con I'm looking forward to continuing to work together, and thanks for taking the time today. For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. I hope that what you've been able to glean from these conversations has been new insights and greater understanding of the complexity and challenges of ensuring that electricity continues to be delivered reliably and affordably to Canadian homes and businesses in this time of great change. Tune in for future episodes, and please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 104. And while you're there, check out the book club page,
which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Lorena's recommendation, Indian in the Cabinet, Speaking Truth to Power, by Jody Wilson-Raybould. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.